we haven't seen before. I mean, North Carolina's got the Research Triangle, and we've got FIO and our marine science community here that's really becoming known, you know, nationally and internationally for the work that's being done here.
The Innovation District.
Absolutely. The Innovation District is something that has been created to really put a spotlight on the incredible work that's being done here.
Wow. And you mentioned the Florida Institute of Oceanography. Now, we've got Mr. Monty Graham is here. How are you doing, Dr. Graham?
I'm very good, thanks.
Type right into that mic.
I gotcha.
All right. So, how did you get your job here?
Ooh, well, I had to apply for it.
Okay.
I've worked in the Gulf of Mexico for almost 30 years. And FIO, the University of South Florida, have just probably the premier reputation as an oceanographic center. And so when the opportunity came up about 3 years ago, it wasn't a hard sell.
Fabulous. What's the main focus of the FIO?
So FIO is, we go back to not long after the St. Pete campus opened up for the University of South Florida back in the late 60s, and so shortly after that, a few universities working together thought, you know, we can't individually own and operate large, expensive research vessels to do the work that we want, so let's establish a coordinating body to do that. And so FIO was born out of that, and we've held to that mission ever since. So we're an operator of three large research vessels and a marine laboratory in the Keys, and we open it up to our membership, which is all 12 institutions of the state university system. Yep.
And it's great to have the support of the city leaders of the place that you're doing all this work at. It's not always like that, is it?
No, it's absolutely not always like that. And sometimes you're working with folks that have a different view of what you have and a different vision for what you have. And so when you do see that path vertically, and I will say, you know, our institution, our host institution, University of South Florida, all the way up to the president, and then our elected officials, all the way up to the state legislature and up to D.C., they're supporters, and that creates that kind of clear path to get things done when everybody's aligned like that.
Because there's a lot of people, we do a lot of environmental stuff on the Florida Folk Show, and we talk about things like the sawtooth fish, the problem there, or Rice's whale. Mm-hmm. And I had a friend of mine, a good friend I've had known for a long time, and when I said, well, have you ever seen a Rice's whale? You know, he's a fisherman all over the Gulf, you know, and there's an area closer to Texas, which is more or less their habitat. And they're thinking about closing that off. And this person just went crazy. What do you mean closing it off? What do we need Rice's whale for? You know, and there's nothing you can say that means anything, you know.
Well, you know, interestingly, one of our other vessels is the Weatherbird. And right now it is being, it's sailing just off to the west and a little bit north of us. And they're pulling some acoustic, very high technology acoustic receivers off the back of the ship, and they are specifically listening for Rice's whales. So we're in the middle of it all the time.
Absolutely. Well, this person next to you, Christopher Sharp. Christopher is what's your title?
Like communications and marketing manager.
Right, and you've been very instrumental in helping us out to make this possible.
Oh, it's a pleasure hosting you.
What does our script say is next?
I think we cut to a musical interlude, and then we introduce some of the other folks from Florida Institute of Oceanography.
Every week we joke about having a script, but I think this is the first time where we legit have a script.
Right.
And it's several pages.
It is.
But I want to thank Gina for coming down. I know just my knowledge of council people, they are working all the time, especially weekends. You might have 10 things to go to in one day. because there's so much going on in St. Pete. Everybody wants you to be there, you know?
Absolutely. And on a beautiful day like today, there are all kinds of things to be, you know, out and about enjoying in St. Petersburg. I just came from the SPCA Pet Walk before I stopped by the Western Flyer, and they're out there with the dogs, and now we're over here talking about jellyfish.
There you go.
Very cool.
All right. Well, what do you say we did get a song here from Mr. Tom Scudero?
Hey, Tom, you want to talk into that mic and tell me how you're doing?
I will. How am I doing?
Oh, well, your guitar is very hot. That's for one. Give me one second.
Tom's coming down all the way from Dade City today to play for us, and he's got to get back to work, but he's one of the great Florida songwriters, and this is... I remember that the first time he did this song, my co-host at the time was a guy named Bobby Hicks, who's I think he pioneered environmental and wildlife folk music in Florida, because he simply was at the meetings. He would get up, big old gruff guy, biker. He was back then. We were on WMNF, and we had phones that people would call up, and he'd answer the phone, and next thing you know, you'd hear him say, "Well, I'm the only Bobby Hicks in the phone book. Come on over," you know. he was like he was going to pick a fight with anybody that dared to mess up the environment. And when he heard Tom's song, he goes, "Well, smuggling, that's part of Florida. I guess that works."
Yeah, he didn't beat me up that day, so I guess it was all right. All right, I'm gonna do two songs, and I got to go to work. All right. This is called The Smuggler. We're on a small plane from Key West on a moonless night, 2 kilos of cocaine. No radio, no lights. Well, I don't know.
Out of my mind. I hear her voice saying, "Please be gone. Take your guitar and your sad, sad songs." I hear her voice saying, "Pack your bags, hit the road. Just go away, hit the road. Go away, hit the road."
Well, I think about my children. Do they miss me tonight? Oh, and how many more broken promises? How much more talk of a good life? Well, I see the bright lights of Tampa. I hope it goes all right. Light a match to check my instruments. And I think about my wife. Well, I touch down in the darkness. No handshakes, and that's fine. That's the life of a smuggler. Maybe I'll do it one more time. On a small plane from Key West, on a moonless night, 2 kilos of cocaine.
always nice hearing that one.
Well, I remember many, many years ago, I was with the Florida Panther recovery team. This is in the 70s. You'd be driving down the Tamiami Trail late at night or in the darkness early in the morning, and all of a sudden the whole world would light up, and there you'd look up, and there'd be a plane coming right over from the Everglades right over Tamiami Trail and landing over there in an area called Golden Gate, where they had already put in roads. And it was one of those things, the schemes to sell Florida land to tourists that came down here. You can buy half of Florida land, but you had to have, if you lived in New York, apparently you couldn't buy the land unless it actually had roads and signs and stuff there. You know,
yes, they built the roads, but none of the infrastructure. Right, any of the structure. Exactly. There's a really good book by Jason Buick called Swamp Peddlers, all about those developments. Definitely highly recommend that.
But that's what they would do, and then the plane would take off. It's amazing to think back now. That doesn't happen. That really doesn't happen anymore. But it's part of Florida, you know.
Yeah.
You ever run into those people out there, Monty?
No, but I'm worried that the Coast Guard's going to come and board the boat here.
Well, hopefully they're
not
listening.
I don't do it anymore. I quit.
Yeah, that's what they all
maybe
say.
Maybe he'll do it one more time. Yeah, but, you know.
Yeah, we slipped everything under the guise of a research vessel mission.
Yeah. Oh, man. Well, so, Tom, did you want to do one more for us?
Yeah, I'll do one more. And, all right. This is I wrote one song with the Gulf of Mexico, and it's all, I'm going to try it for you. Captain Morgan sailed the seven seas, and I stood to his right. Cross-eyed Jack had his way with a cabin boy and a whale singing at night down on the Gulf of Mexico. Now I've been where the wind comes from a crow's nest I cursed the sun. Made a deal with the devil, sold my fish-cold soul.
That's my Gulf of Mexico song.
Okay. We've got another. Would you introduce her?
Absolutely.
Chris?
So Dr. Nicole Reyno, she's FIO's chief scientist, and she's going to be talking about the future of FIO's capabilities when it comes to deep sea exploration and previewing our incoming state-of-the-art remotely operated vehicle. So,
all right. What is a remotely operated vehicle?
High-tech robot that is going to be here sitting on these moon pool doors, but attached to a 2.5-mile cable that sends it down to the seafloor. So we don't have to send humans down. We are here happy on the ship with operators and scientists while the robot takes live video of the seafloor, comes up live, and so we're able to watch and see and really observe and explore the seafloor. We can take samples with it. We can add all different sorts of sensors to help us understand the deep sea.
And what do you see on the seafloor?
Oh, something new every time you send the robot down. Yeah, that's the most incredible thing is no matter where you go in the ocean, there's something new. Almost every expedition, you're discovering new species of animals that we just didn't know existed. Yeah. So having the Gulf of Mexico and researchers is really unique. Remotely operated vehicles like this are very rare for researchers to have access to. And I think one of the really incredible things about what we're doing is we're allowing students access to them too. So we're trying to help a new generation of students become aware and capable of using these.
Where is the ROV?
So right now it's being built. We'll take ownership of it in May. It'll start being integrated into the vessel. But right now it's in a place called East Aurora, New York. The frame of it was built in Largo, Florida.
I know where that is.
Yeah, and so it's up there in the icy cold having all the sensors and different components put on it right now.
Well,
What sort of sensors is it being equipped with?
Yeah, so it'll have a 4K video camera. That's the main thing that scientists will use. But then it has the capability to have different sensors, like to detect salinity, temperature. It will have great navigation equipment, which is really important so that when you find something spectacular, you can actually go back to it.
There you go.
Yeah, mapping equipment. And then a really large area where you could put samples. And that's important because when you see something new, you can't really tell what it is until you take a little bit of it or you take a sample and bring it up for scientists to look at.
Have you ever run into any Spanish gold down there?
No, we have found some really interesting shipwrecks, though, and that's,
really?
I think, some of the most exciting work, even, you know, especially in the Gulf of Mexico, and part of our program this year with the students and the researchers are to investigate a few shipwrecks. Some of the work is going back to see how those shipwrecks kind of change over time, but these are shipwrecks that are hundreds of years old and mostly sank in storms, and, you know, they're also interesting things here from past wars. There are U-boats here in the Gulf of Mexico. Yep.
Whatever happened to the Bounty, didn't it? The Bounty wrecked somewhere up off the East Coast.
It did, yeah. Monty, I don't know if you know any more about that than I do. Yeah, sorry.
Let me Google that for you.
But that was a famous boat here in St. Petersburg, and they used to have concerts on the boat. They'd put a band up there, and then people would be in. It was on the approach to the pier for years and years. I don't know what it was doing. I never seen it go anywhere. And all of a sudden, one time, they just took it, and it never came back.
Well, you know, one of the other things about the ocean is that we don't have maps of the seafloor yet. And so that's my one of my passions is having better maps. Even off the coast of Florida here, we don't know what the seafloor looks like. And so being able to have those capabilities and understand the depth and the shape of the seafloor is foundational, really.
Yeah, FIO also hosts the Florida Coastal Mapping Program, so that's one of our collaborative missions.
Yeah, so we try to pull in other agencies, people like Saildrin here, who have autonomous mapping vessels that can go out and go through hurricanes and map the seafloor as they go along, are helping really pull together maps of the area.
Does that connect with climate change? A map of the coast, and as the coast changes, what about the ocean?
For sure. I mean, storms really impact the seafloor and the shape of the seafloor here, and particularly for navigational safety, we have to, after hurricanes, routinely go and remap areas so we can make sure they're safe for people to go fishing and sailing through.
You're listening to the Florida Folk Show on Radio St. Pete. We'd like to thank the Will McLean Foundation for their support for the Florida Folk Show. The foundation produces the annual Will McLean Music Festival featuring all Florida artists, monthly concerts, and they award annual college scholarships. The Will McLean Foundation also operates the Florida Sand Music Ranch, formerly the Sertoma Youth Ranch.
Well, that is excellent. Well, please keep in touch with us. I see that there's the Pierside Program Workforce Development Program for underserved communities. Just tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so this is a really great new program. We're in our first full year this year. We're going to take 8 mentors and 23 students out to see with us. But they're
what age?
Community college through early career. And it really allows the student to fully develop a program and understand how expeditions come together, whether they're interested in research or more technical skills or professional maritime careers. We try to find that spot for the students to shadow and really get mentorship to find their ocean careers.
Wow.
Yeah,
that's
so they'll
excellent.
Sail for a week on the ship and be on shore doing remote science. So we have, you know, not only is the robot sending all of its video and data to the ship, but it goes to shore now. And so people can be watching from shore.
Oh, that's really cool.
That's an FIO program?
Yes.
All right, yeah.
If people want to find out more information about that program or the research that you guys will be publishing, where could they find that?
Yeah, they should go to the FIO website, and then there's a Pierside tab to learn more.
Great.
FIO.usf.edu.
There you go.
Okay. Well, thank you for coming down. That was great. Maybe we can have you come back, you know, if you find something interesting or another program or anything, please feel free to contact us to come on.
That sounds back. Great. I'm sure
it might not be on the boat. Yeah. We might be somewhere else, you know, but you never know.
Wherever we can get an internet connection, I suppose.
Well, Tim.
So you want me to play a song and then we'll get Pat Barmore?
Yeah, let's do that. All right. We'll play a song. We'll get Mr. Pat Barmore. He's got to go back to work, too.
All these working men.
Yeah.
For the population reasons, for the seasons and the sun, Florida is forever placed choices between creeks or canals, marshes or marinas. Beaches or barriers, sunshine or smog, man or machines. Greenlands or the ghettos, pavement or palmettos. How we make these choices and the uses of the land will surely etch the future of Florida. But the most important thing of all is that we save our state. As we know her, as we love her. For the future generations, for the seasons in the sun, Florida is forever based on choices between. Choices between.
All right, that was Dale Kreider, and now we are bringing up Pat Barmore, and Pete is on the other side of the table now. Hey, Pat, how you doing?
Good. How you doing, Tim?
Good, good. All right, so what are you going to play for us?
A song I wrote for the most endangered species in the state of Florida, the Florida fisherman.
There you go.
Oh, boy.
I moved to Indian Rocks Beach. I was 11 years old, and the only paved road was Gulf Boulevard. The coast of Florida was full of fishing villages, and Millar's restaurant on Indian Rocks Beach, you could get all the fish you could eat for a buck. And
well, that sounds awesome.
That has certainly changed. So I wrote this song about the generations of fishing and how it's not so much about fishing as a way of life, and it's called High Tide. These waters have brought me home on an easy inbound road, like my father and his father before. We are patient with what nature holds. We make our lives from the sea and the good times and the bad. As a family, we stay strong with the simple philosophy. Wait for high tide, it always comes back around. Wait for high tide, you'll never run aground. Wait for high tide, it will always get you home. And these islands hold the cycle of life. Sure as you're born, you're gonna die. So there's fathers and sons and grandpa, and a grandma and a daughter and a wife. Traditions we hold and keep, for the Calusa and the spirits of the sea. And with friends we trust and respect, we all sing this in harmony. Wait for high tide, it always comes back around. Wait for high tide, you'll never run aground. Wait for high tide, it will always get you home. So keep your rudder straight in the storm. From adversity, strength is born. Hold your children and your family close, like a wave you can break and reform. And we must meet our destiny when we hear the call of the sea. Though at times it's hard to believe, when our boats get tossed by the breeze, we wait for high tide. It always comes back around. Wait for high tide, and you'll never run aground. Wait for high tide, it will always get you home. And love will always get you home.
All right.
Thank you, Tim.
Thank you, Pat.
Thanks for all the work you guys do, too. Keep it up. We need clean water. We need clean air. And that's not political. That's
Amen.
What we need.
All right, absolutely.
All right, well, here's another song about Gulf fishermen by Bobby Hicks, Zachariah Creech.
Creech wasn't just another shrimper, doctor's board at Cedar Key. A few things about him made him a little different than those other sons of the sea. He trawled the Gulf since he was 10 years old and Tortugas to Tampico. Done some time back in 29 for hauling whiskey out of Port St. Joe. Yeah, he looked to be as old as the water that it etched his face and lines. The Gulf was his mother, when was his father? Zachariah Creech was a friend of mine. I used to see him at the docks in Crystal River, the bars down in Tarpon Springs. Drank Canadian mist neath the moon of silver, at night sometimes he'd sing.
He sang of the days when the money came easy, it had a family and a home. Well, then he sang of a hurricane that came, left old Zach alone. Carried the loss upon his shoulder from that storm back in 33. He drowns his sorrow in the whiskey, the sun and the wind and the sea. He reminisced about days on Tampa Bay, back when a shrimper still had respect. He said a man of the sea was somebody then, you could judge him by the way he run a net. It's a dying art, he used to tell me, well, nobody wants to learn it all anymore. For nowadays it's all electronics, they use to rape the ocean's floor. He said I only trawled enough to make a living, now they're making 3 trips to my one. They're taking a lot more than the water is giving, won't be nothing left at all in the dump. He handed me down his old guitar, I gave the bottle another pull. Said all I need are the sun and the stars, and every once in a while my belly to be full. Besides I'm what many call an old man, I've lived more than I got left. Write a song for me and the sons of the sea, so those who care will not forget. He said, write about the old Gulf fishermen, how we held out as long as we could. Those of us that fish by instinct and build our boats out of wood. Well, I sat down with my fountain pen, I tried to capture his life in my lines. About a man of the sea, born in Steinhatchee, he died on his boat back in 79. He was a different kind of a sailor, a different sea from a different time. You know, Zachariah Creech was an old Gulf shrimper. Zachariah Creech was a friend of mine. Mother, the wind was his father. Zachariah Creech was a friend of mine.
That was Bobby Hicks, Zachariah Creech, a Florida folk classic, in my opinion. I don't know.
Now, Tim,
yes.
Gina Driscoll from the St. Pete City Council is still with us. And,
she is.
She's got to leave, but she's just gave us an amazing note. First time, I guess, anybody has ever heard about it or not. I don't know. I didn't know it. But she says that Monty here, who is the director of the Florida Institute of Oceanography, has a jellyfish named after him. Is that correct?
Do you want me to?
Yeah. I mean, that's it's not named after me. I don't know.
Yeah.
That is correct, isn't it, Gina?
It is. And, you know, Monty is a humble guy. I've known him for several years now. But I think it was just 2 or 3 years ago that there was breaking news in the marine science world that a jellyfish was named after Monty,
and not just one. It was a whole species.
Oh, right, an entire species, because that's fitting for Monty Graham. Yeah.
Where's it located?
It's actually here in the Gulf of Mexico. It's one of the more common ones. So people look at them as they're called moon jellyfish. You know, they're very common in the late summer and fall. And it was determined to be a new species because of its genetic dissimilarity to other species that were going by the same previous name. And so they had to come up with a new species name. And because I had worked on them for about 30 years, they got the...
Is it an endangered species?
Not at all.
Not at all.
Not at all. No, in fact, jellyfish do quite well under human perturbations, you know, like fishing and over harvesting, not just fishing, but over harvesting of fish and nutrient pollution, things like that. Jellyfish tend to do quite well.
And the genus is called Aurelia Montii.
Yes,
that's fun.
I see. Okay.
And my granddaughter's name is Aurelia.
Oh, all right. There you go.
I did not know that. So I
thought, that's a beautiful name.
I thought the first part of the name was just something sciencey.
It is.
They named her after the
jellyfish.
She's named after the jellyfish that's named after you. Yeah. All right.
Full circle.
This is getting a little complicated, but I think I'm following the plot still.
I think there were years ago there was a rabbit down in the Keys, and somehow it got the name Hefneri. It was named after Hugh Hefner.
It turned out that this rabbit was
endangered, and they wanted to close part of the airport that was on Isla Mirada, I think it was, and not use it anymore because this rabbit was out there. And people were standing up at the council meeting saying, you know, this rabbit is named after Hugh Hefner. Come on, man. It can't be endangered. There's,
It's not a thing.
Very hilarious situation, but a true situation that occurred back in those days. What do we got next here, Tom? Thank you, Gina, for that interjection there.
You're welcome.
I don't know.
Tom, we'd love to describe to the viewers what, you know, the area that we're sitting in right now.
Yeah.
And I'll turn it over to Monty.
Yeah. So if you want our captains to come on down and start joining us. But just real quick, you know, the space that we're in inside the Western Flyer is pretty unique. And so some of the folks that are just listening won't be able to really fully appreciate it. But there's a lot of machinery around us right now. And it's cranes and big drums of cable that our captains here that are joining us will describe further. But the reason why that is because the remotely operated vehicle that Dr. Raynaud talked about is not an insubstantial piece of equipment. In fact, it's quite large. It's going to be 7 feet tall, 7 feet long, and 5 feet wide, and it's going to weigh somewhere around 4,000 pounds. So it's a small mini.
Oh my goodness!
so it needs this big equipment to handle it, and it's not a, you know, it's not something that just anybody with, you know, very little training can do this. And so as we kind of segue into our folks that really represent the crew of FIO, I'll brag on them a little bit, is that they are the most professional crew I have ever worked with in my 30 years, and it extends beyond just their knowledge of the machinery, and it's that they are part instructors. They teach the students and the early career folks when they're out at sea, because we get some people that are not very comfortable sometimes, and so it's been an honor and a privilege to have a crew on our three vessels like the ones that we have.
Do you you can't compare this though to that the vessel that went deep in this on the Titanic, the one that imploded or exploded.
Well, actually, it's the same. It's very much the same technology that was the remotely operated vehicle that went down and unfortunately, you know, that was when we learned the fate of the submersible. But the company that is building our remotely operated vehicle is the company that went down with their other vehicle that this one's based off of.
And when will that arrive here?
The ROV is delivered in May, and the ROV's name is the is called Taurus, and Taurus the bull. So we're our institution here. Our host is the University of South Florida, the Bulls.
Right.
You know, an astronomical sort of nod to, you know, the celestial role that Mariners had. And so it's the Taurus, and it will be a Taurus because it is being delivered astrologically during the
I hope it doesn't end up being too stubborn.
Well, I understand that this vessel here is going to be taking off on a trip and has something to do with the cable. I think the captain here, Quentin, was talking about it earlier. Where is he?
Yeah,
oh, there he is, right to my left. Tell us a little bit about what you're going to be doing there.
Oh, this is going to be kind of a short trip, but we actually have to go. Thank you. We actually have to go south of Cuba. That's the closest place we can find deep enough water to wind the cable out. We have 4,600 meters of cable. So this ROV is actually rated to a depth of 4,000 meters, but we've got a little bit more cable than that. But in order to have the cable relaxed before the ROV is attached to it when it comes in May, we actually have to take the cable offshore in deep water and wind it completely off the winch and let it just relax itself as it goes down. So that's 50 miles south of Cuba is the closest place we can go to do that without the cable touching the bottom.
In all the Gulf of Mexico, there's not a place that deep.
No, this is 2.5 miles. I'm doing the math for you real quick here.
Thank you. Yeah.
two and a half miles.
Wow.
How long is it going to take you guys to get out there?
It'll take us almost 2 days, well, just over 2 days to get down there, and then probably 12 to 18 hours to actually do the work, and then another 2 days back.
And who else is going with you?
Well, we have a crew of 10, but we're actually also carrying a group of students from some of the colleges around Florida. It's not a science cruise per se. It is a science cruise, but we're not actually stopping to do other work other than this cable wind out. But we got a group of students that wanted to ride along. They get an opportunity, you know, because a lot of times going out and doing oceanographic research, you think of it as just being able to for everybody to understand what a ship is, but a lot of these students that are going may never have been on a ship. So even though we're not going to do any other work, they'll get 6 days of riding, talking to the crew, understanding what a ship is all about, what a research ship is all about.
And so this is a pretty unique ship. When we first visited y'all, you were telling us about the design of it, like the little underwater, I don't know, can you describe that in bed with whatever, how the, you know, it goes below the waves, keeps it steady. Yeah,
right.
Whatever.
The ship is actually called a SWATH, S-W-A-T-H, which stands for Small Waterplane Area Twin Hull. So it's kind of a hybrid. It's not a catamaran, but the two hulls are actually very wide apart, and the buoyancy for the ship is actually very far below the waves. So it's a very stable platform. That's part of the reason when the ship was designed to do the ROV work, that's why they selected this particular design. This is one of the few ships, for anybody that's ever been on any ship, that you can walk on board and walk up in the galley and see that the galley chairs, the places where everybody eats, the chairs aren't bolted to the deck because this ship rides so good.
That's really awesome.
Smooth sailing.
Something like that.
Scotty Lee was telling me earlier that he watched a video of the Western Flyer on YouTube, and he said it was very fascinating. I'm going to check that out after the
podcast. Yeah, I guess that's what he was telling me, too, some sort of like 16-minute long video. I don't know. Maybe Scotty can post a link to it on the Facebook chat or something if he feels so inclined.
Well, one of the first things I found out about this vessel is that it left California to come here, and it had to go through the Panama Canal.
Right.
Were you at the hull there, or the captain's chair on that one?
I brought the ship from Monterey Bay.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, first, let me just mention one thing that you mentioned about the ship design.
Oh.
You can go online. Well, actually, you just Google Moonpool, M-O-O-N-P-O-O-L, and you will actually get a picture from Wikipedia of this ship taken in a dry dock from underneath, so you can actually see what the moon pool looks like.
What we're sitting on top of right
and
now.
What we're sitting on top of right now, right. It was a 35-day trip. It took us longer than that to actually transfer all the paperwork from Monterey Bay Aquarium to FIO and USF before we could actually get underway. In fact, we left Monterey Bay and had to stop in San Diego and wait for our last document to clear before we could actually head down to the canal to get through the canal. And, of course, today with the Internet and satellite communications, we got the document while we were underway. The trip was, it was a fairly easy trip, 4,450 miles. We, I don't know if I should say this or not, but we trolled, we fished the entire trip. We caught three mahi, so that's one fish every 1,500 miles. it was a good thing we weren't counting on that for meals, but it was a good trip. Pretty uneventful other than going through the canal, which is a, I've not been through it before. Captain Boomer, who's here with us, has been through multiple times, so it was a, I've checked that off my bucket list. I don't think I want to go back and do it again, not like that. It was a very good trip, smooth sailing, but it was a, it's a lot of work to get through the canal.
I saw him do it, you know, go through the canal, and it was amazing because we thought we were going to get the lines with the trains pulling us through and easy peasy, and at the last minute they said, no, you have to drive through, so no lines, and so he had to do
so
it.
So you didn't have freehand. You didn't have a tugboat or a, like these guys that bring in the ships into the channel in Tampa?
No. We had a tug sitting in front of us. For the small ships like this going through the Panama Canal, they don't get to go through by themselves. They put multiple ships in the locks, and we went through with three other ships, one of which was an old Panamanian tugboat that needed an overhaul, and it sat in front of us with the wind blowing our way, and every time it moved we just got a big ball of black smoke coming from the ship in front of us. And the canal pilot, who was standing with me and supposed to be with me the whole time while I was trying to maneuver the ship going through the locks, he actually stepped back inside the pilot house to get out of the smoke and just left me out there by myself. So it was an interesting trip.
That sounds interesting. So you are listening to the Florida Folk Show on Radio St. Pete, Sunshine 96.7 FM, WMTB LP St. Petersburg, where local music lives.
And support for the Florida Folk Show comes from the Will McLean Foundation, Incorporated. The foundation produces the annual Will McLean Music Festival featuring all Florida artists. They also produce monthly concerts and award annual college scholarships. The Will McLean Foundation also operates the Florida Sand Music Ranch, formerly the Sertoma Youth Ranch.
All right.
Now, Boomer, you've been through the canal numerous times.
Yeah, I have. Many times.
Many times.
Well, I think three, so not
there you go.
Well, he said a dozen, so
No, I think it's just three. I've been through the Suez, too, which is pretty interesting.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And the Corinth, if you ever saw that in Greece, it's pretty interesting.
Wow. What is the deal with the canals, these big canals?
Well, they're essential to global traffic. You know, obviously it cuts the transit way down if you don't have to go all the way around the tip of South America.
Yeah, you remember that, you know, the freighter, the container ship, the Evergreen. That.
Oh, yeah, that was crazy.
The Suez, yeah.
Yeah, that tells you what happens if you shut those down.
It's also hugely, you know, an economic advantage for those countries that have those canals. They obviously charge.
It's part of the country, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It's a big income generator.
There you go.
So Boomer has been here longer than most of us at FIO, and so he's got a pretty good sense of the role that FIO plays in training students and has a lot of stories.
Yeah, I started just doing relief work, and that was 13 years ago.
He's been captain on all three of the ships that are here now.
Yeah, it's pretty unique in that you're always doing something different. You know, you're not carrying cargo from point A to point B. Like Monty said, you know, there's a lot of instruction and training and teaching involved, which is pretty important to us. You know, it keeps us interested. Ever-changing projects, you know, every cruise is different. You know, we have to come up with innovative ways to load equipment, you know, and execute missions. So it's a, in terms of a ship job, it's very interesting and very rewarding.
Where do all your students come from? Different places, or all from USF? Or
A lot from USF often, but from all over the state, all over the country, and even all over the world. So all kinds of different students. It kind of depends on who's using us. You know, we could have a institution from, you know, the Pacific Northwest bringing students here. Obviously, all the state universities here in Florida bring a lot of students. So we see quite a few students, graduate and undergraduate, and even some K-12 here and there.
There are only a couple dozen research vessels that are capable of getting away from shore like that, you know, in the United States. And so, the efficiency of moving gear from, you know, Seattle to do work in Florida is very high compared to like trying to get a ship from somewhere to Seattle. So, you know, people will come all over the place to work with us and use our ships.
Are you seeing more students now that are in those disciplines that have to do with marine science, or even ones that are there looking into climate change issues or red tide?
We see students that are interested in all kinds of things, engineering, science, you know, technology. We do all kinds of different red tide work. You mentioned that. We know Moat Marine Laboratory in Sarasota, as well as FWC. Lots of red tide work as well.
Well, Tim?
Yeah?
Didn't you have a question about red tide?
Do I have a question about red tide? I don't know.
Having to do with Piney Point?
What about it?
We did respond to Piney Point. Monty can probably talk better on the science side of things than I can, but being an operator and a facilitator, don't quite always understand the full scope of the science, but Monty there does.
Thanks. Nothing like a hot potato issue to talk
We're
about.
We're just boat drivers.
No, Piney Point was an absolutely avoidable and terrible event that occurred. And no doubt it had local impacts that, very likely, influenced, the biology of things in Tampa Bay and adjacent. And, the things that we don't understand about a Piney Point happening is the downrange sort of impacts, that even once the water is diluted out and the nutrients, the chemicals that were associated with it are long gone, did it shift something in the biological system that then kind of echoes through time? And so those are, valid scientific questions. Florida, has an interesting relationship with water, right? To say the least, and whether it's salt water or fresh water, we have a lot of people, and people want access to the water, and they want to use water, and that's the moral of the story, is we have to be careful how we use the water, because there are unintended consequences of a healthy, vibrant economy that also impact the way that the water might impact us if it's polluted with chemicals or so right now we're all watching the water that's being discharged from Okeechobee and out on the coast.
So. And its effect on the manatee and all kinds of different species.
It's everything from single cell organisms that form the base of the food chain all the way up to manatees and whales, and it's a lot of questions still out there to answer.
We're pretty good at staying operationally ready for events like that, whether it be a bloom or a Piney Point or a Deepwater Horizon. We kind of always on standby, because obviously when an event like that happens, scientists want to get out there as soon as they can. And, our ships being operationally ready at a moment's notice is pretty important.
There you go.
And then I read in the paper, I think yesterday or today, this is going to be one of the biggest hurricane seasons in
That's
a long
what
time.
They're predicting, apparently.
11 storms predicted to hit the peninsula.
Woo.
they mentioned the Atlantic Ocean is warmer than it's supposed to be, or usually.
Well, we're coming off of, you know, even though it's more local, we have, you know, our marine lab down in the Florida Keys is the Keys Marine Laboratory, and we were in the middle of the coral rescue last year, and 5,000 something corals from nurseries were pulled into our facilities in the Keys because of the hot water that developed locally down in the Keys last year, and so we're tracking that again this year, you know, asking the question, you know, what's the water temperature like right now compared to a year ago, and it's actually higher
That's
temperature.
Crazy.
So we're getting prepared for that, you know, in addition to, you know, a lot of attention with sawfish and now we're also, you throw on top of that hurricanes, right? So yeah. If you're in the middle of all this rescue and restoration and all this, you know, it takes one hurricane to make it a really bad day for everybody and reset the whole effort.
And we had a pretty big response to Ian.
Yeah.
Ian did a number on Fort Myers. We were down there very soon after doing water sampling and water chemistry work to see what was going on there.
And we sent our research vessel to Hogarth down there. The scientists from down there got emergency funding from National Science Foundation, I believe, and then we immediately, they came here, got on the ship, and we immediately responded.
I had a question, just bringing it back to red tide, something that affects us all here. So when you guys look at the long-term effects of what the red tide, like the Pineport disaster, did to the local area, when you give that research to the EPA, are they going to, do you see any like change for how they're going to control these jib stacks that cause this? Like, have you seen any movement on that?
Well, so you're creating a lot of points that have some, you know, different waypoints in there between what we do as basic mm-hmm. science. So we can bring out, you know, state scientists and the work that they do has direct regulatory impact. If it's a university scientist, typically what the goal is to answer an unknown question that can then be pulled in down the road into a regulatory framework. But the connection between, you know, what this boat, you know, will go out and do for Piney Point last year, we were trying to get to basic, you know, information about what were the chemicals and how long are they in the water before they dilute out, you know, just into background of the ocean, you know, where are the models predicting that the water will go, and is it going where we thought it was going to go? If not, why not? You know, those kinds of questions. So those don't really lead to direct regulatory aspects of the gypsum stacks. You know, those laws are already in place, and you know, and they're heading in the, I think, in the right direction for decommissioning and cleaning these up.
So as far as climate change, the work that you're doing is the front row seat. I mean,
you can't get more front row.
Right. You can't be a climate denier.
No, and honestly, and this is an apolitical comment, is, you know, we're in a state that is a peninsula, surrounded by water on three sides, and is very low in profile. And so I don't hear anybody denying that things are changing, that, you know, sea level is rising, and where the more political elements of the argument come is the what to do and how to do. And my own philosophy on response to climate for society is deconstruct the problem from being a, you know, people want to wrap around this, you know, it's a 1,000-year problem. You know, we have to deal with the next 50 years. Let's get through the next 50 years so that 50 years can buy us a complete change in the way we do things. But if we can start this now and break down a 1,000-year problem down into smaller segments of doable things, and I think if we focus on the next 2-3 generations of decision makers, we'll be in a really good spot after that. But it's going to take looking at what those things that we can do right in front of us and how to make change, and then proceeding for the next 50 years.
All right. Now, what is the honors, this program that you've got here called the Honoring the Ocean program?
Honoring the Ocean was the brainchild of Dr. Monty Graham, and it is a collaboration between five honors colleges in the state of Florida and FIO, where we provide an opportunity for students from every discipline imaginable, not just marine science, not just bio, but we have anthropology, political science, art majors participating in a little mini course that introduces them to the different ways in which people interact with the ocean and research the ocean depending on their field. And then FIO provides them an opportunity to go out on a research vessel and see what that is like.
All right. That's interesting.
Yeah, we actually just saw the projects of the of this year's cohort yesterday. It was a semester-long kind of culmination of projects, and the projects were super impressive. I mean, they blew us away. What do you think, Monty?
Yeah, we have students who are writing poetry, who are making paintings, who are 3D printing,
ROVs.
We had a student create some amazing nail art based on marine creatures that we pulled up while we were trawling on the research vessel. Just incredibly creative reflections on what it means to be human and be in relationship with the ocean.
Where could people see these artworks?
Well, FIO has a great website dedicated to honoring the ocean, and we're going to be putting this year's creative projects on there. This is the second year we've done honoring the ocean. And so we've had now 40 students participate in this experience. They tend to be students who are first year in college, who maybe otherwise wouldn't get a chance to be out on a research vessel, but FIO is giving them this opportunity, trying to make the seas more accessible.
And Pete, we're actually joined by two of those students today.
Reelers?
The Reelers from the last song.
So also they double as Reelers for live music broadcasts. But this is Josephine Combs and Elise Perfett. They're both USF Honors College students, so I'm going to welcome them up.
Well, Josephine and
Elise.
Tell us really quickly what you think about this program. And why did you even join it?
So I'm a political science major, but I've always had an interest in the ocean as a child and till now, and that's kind of the reason why I came to Florida for school. I'm originally from New York, but I wanted to be in a beautiful campus, which St. Pete definitely has, and we're really close to the ocean, which is important to me. And so with Honoring the Oceans, as an honor student, I think interdisciplinarity is, like, super important. So by being able to immerse myself with students of different majors, like marine bio majors and art majors, as we previously mentioned, I really learned from my cohort and from all of the professors, because we had, like, a bunch of different lectures, including art history and lightning whelks, specifically in the significance of lightning whelks with indigenous people in Florida, as well as, like, maritime law, and we talked about other things like creative nonfiction and things like that. And it was really important for me to learn all of that, especially in my first year, which is pretty defining to my college experience. So,
where do you go to college?
The University of South Florida.
South Florida,
go
okay.
Go Bulls.
What about you, Elise?
Oh, I'm Josephine.
Josephine, I'm sorry. Where did I get that from?
Funnily enough, I started this semester an environmental science major, and then throughout the semester, as I did Honoring the Oceans, I actually made the switch to marine biology. So, claps. it actually has been a transformative experience. The voyage itself on the Hogarth and the Western Flyer was incredible. It's like one thing to, like, see the ocean and, like, be on a boat docked, and it's another thing entirely to be out offshore. And, you know, you're taking water samples and soil samples and trolling and catching biological specimens. It was really special. And then additionally, the lectures that we had, especially from Dr. Wilkins, I'm sure I'll always remember the lightning whelk, and the, like, Tokabaga people and their relationship to the ocean, as well as we had, like Elise said, art lectures and how the ocean can, you know, affect art and influence it. So, incredible experience. Yeah.
Well, that's fantastic. The ocean is a part of everything.
Yep, it is.
That's what it sounds like. That students that do have the ability to understand that, this is a great program for them.
Yep.
Fantastic. Did you have anything else that you had to add to this?
Well, I think Josephine's going to be skipping school for the next week.
I am.
No, that's not okay. You shouldn't be skipping school.
I got an email this Wednesday, so pretty last minute, about a ride-along on the Western Flyer. And I emailed Dr. Wilkins, or Dr. Wilkins emailed me, or vice versa. And I was like, Dr. Wilkins, I think I have to do this. And Dr. Wilkins was like, yes, I think you do. And so I'm pretty excited about it. It felt like an opportunity I couldn't pass up. And, you know, one night on the Western Flyer wasn't enough. So, you know, six more days.
Yeah, I just have to say FIO has been incredibly generous, not just to our USF students, but they really do represent all of the educational institutions in the state of Florida and have worked hard to bring us all together to share our mutual love of the ocean and learn from them and use their resources. So we're really grateful to FIO. Best use of tax dollars ever.
All right. Fantastic. So remember that name, the Honors...
Honoring the ocean.
Honoring the ocean. Yes, we should put something like that on our website, Tim.
Yeah, we can throw up some links on the
I've got some links
Facebook
to it.
Page.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. All right, well.
Well, I think we need to get, she came all the way from Lake Placid, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay. This is Rita Youngman, and she's going, she is a member of the Seminole Tribe of Florida, and she is a singer-songwriter. And she's got a song about Egmont Key.
I do. I have one.
And why did you write about Egmont Key?
Well, we in the Seminole tribe, we have our own archaeologist, and they asked me if I'd like to go out there with them because I was kind of interested, you know, studying the history of our people that were here. And in this area, the Tucapachi people were here, and they were the people that made the law. And then... the Calusa carried it all out. And they made sure they were kind of like the police because they were big and intimidating. So that's how this whole culture was. And, you know, everybody calls it Florida, but we, our area, by what my ancestors told me, our area is from the Keys all the way up to the Tennessee River, all the way to the Mississippi. So when I went out to Egmont Key, part of the story is when the soldiers wanted the land, they came and collected all the people off of the land and would ship some of them over to Egmont Key. So they couldn't swim, right, because of the currents and stuff. And they would ship a lot of them in, write their names down, and then when they shipped them out, there wasn't very many names going out. So we were looking for a mass grave. So that's what we were doing out there. And while we were doing that, we were going to plan on going, like, maybe a couple months later. Then lightning struck the island and burnt everything down. And so we could really see what was there. And there was a lot of things that we discovered besides. I think they discovered a new building out there and all kinds of stuff.
They did. They discovered a new building that they didn't know was there because the foliage was so thick in the middle of that island.
So it was.
That's where they held the Seminole Indians. And when they got 30 or 40 of them, they put them on a ship up the Mississippi River to join the Choctaw and the Cherokee going to Oklahoma.
And those are some warring people. Yeah, they didn't like each other, so they tried to kill each other too. Mm-hmm. So they
you've
were
got a song about all that. Right?
Well, it's not about the fighting part, but yeah, about Egmont Key. Yes, mm-hmm. It's about what when we went out there, and this is the song that just. I was inspired to write after visiting that place, which was, it was in 2016. So that's how long ago it's been.
Oh.
Oh, that lighthouse shines on that big, white, beautiful island. While the sailboats glide off into that big, blue ocean. Tourists, they ride that ferry boat just for fun. But it reminds me of those shipped into that Seminole prison. Tiny white crosses on Egg Monkey, lonely reminders of our own Seminole. Captives, they came, some remain in a mass grave. I hear them calling me out of those dunes on Egmont's Key. Oh, those turquoise skies look just like a Gila breeze. While the dolphin play in the waters of old Tucobache, the hot white sand reflects all of the day's heat. While I ponder the history that's buried beneath my feet, silent voices, they're calling my name. Come and find us, don't let them take us away. Our lost souls are restless out on this beach. Till this day on Egmont Key. Tiny white crosses on Egmont Key. Lonely reminders of our own sin. They came, some remain in a mass grave. I hear them calling me out of those dunes on Egmont's Key. I hear them calling me out of those dunes on Egmont's Key.
Thank you.
Have you heard of Red Bays over there in the Bahamas?
Red Bays in the Bahamas?
Yeah.
No, but I know you know about that.
It's a little... What was it? Well, I mean, it's part of Seminole history. It's a place where the Seminoles actually, during the Seminole Wars, they got their canoes and they put sails on them, and they sailed across to the nearest, which was Andros Island, was the nearest land that from where they left, yeah. And they just created a civilization there.
Well, that makes sense.
And
because,
years later, they still have a archway over the little town there.
Oh.
And then somebody did stonework, and they carved pictures of canoes with sails
right.
that coming over there. And the people all had names that were Seminole names.
The creek names.
Yeah, the creek names and even the clans, that sort of thing.
Oh.
And it's still there. There's several places like that. There's one in Texas.
Yes, I do know about that one.
Cuba. Castro actually built a...
I did not know about that one.
Yeah, he built a little Indian village for the Miccosukees.
Mm-hmm.
So those are very interesting. But that Red Bays was very interesting because there were some very elderly people when we went over there that were just a couple generations away from the people that actually came over. Well, did you have one more that you could do? And we'll bring Scotty back up to finish the end of the show.
I do. It's called Imadaloyi. It's a little bit of a long song, but it's about a young woman who they captured and they put onto a ship. And they shipped her out here, and they stop, and she gets away. And her name's Imadaloyi. Y'all know her by Polly Parker. So,
right.
But her creek name is Imadaloyi, and that means the gatherer. So it was very fitting for that. So, and then I found out some more stuff about her after that, after I wrote this song, which was pretty cool. So. It all happened in 1856. She was caught with others to ship out west. Like cargo they went under the soldiers' torments on Old Gray Cloud, the steamboat prison. Imadaloyi, Imadaloyi, where are you? The land it calls your name. Come back home, don't come alone. As fast as you can, Imadaloyi, back to Okeechobee. The stop at St. Mark's was the plan. And Polly knew she'd never again see her clan. Songs were sung to distract. She could never look back as they scattered to the home of the swamplands. Imadaloyi, Imadaloyi, where are you? The land calls your name. Come back home, don't come alone. As fast as you can, Imadaloyi, back to Okeechobee. On ancient paths they travel by the moonlight, eating garfish and berries on their plight. Fearsome beast of the field, they showed them no yield as they scattered to the home in the south. The shores of Fish-Eating Creek were her home. She was 100 and something when she passed on. She was the hope for all to see, to keep our land and be free. And oh, golly, Okeechobee. Imadaloyi, Imadaloyi, where are you? The land calls your name. Come back home, don't come alone. As fast as you can, Imadaloyi, back to Okeechobee. Imadaloyi, Imadaloyi, where are you? so much more. But that is it.
Well, you know, some anthropologist came along and did a descendancy study about Polly Parker, Imadaloi. And it turns out that almost all of the leaders of the Seminole tribe come from her family.
There's many. Yes, they
do. So, it's really amazing, yeah.
That is.
Well, thank you, Rita.
Yes, sir. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Stick around. We'll go to breakfast.
Okay. I can do that. I like food. All right.
Where did Scotty go? Is he going to play one more for us? And we can sign
off? We can
off?
Do that, or I can play a song, or I don't know.
He's got this guitar there.
So. All right. Scotty, so there's a separate quarter inch on the floor. Let's give that one a whirl. All right, fine, whatever then. I guess we'll just go back to Mike and you. Fine.
And while they get set up, Radio St. Pete would like to thank the Will McLean Foundation for their support of the Florida Folk Show. Yeah. And we are here on the RV Western Flyer. Thank you guys so much.
Right. And Monty, Dr. Monty Graham, thank you so much for joining us. I wish you were here with us every week.
We can make that happen.
Okay. Hey, there we go.
All right.
Thank you very much for being here.
All right, Scotty, what are you playing?
Well, we have a beautiful river here in Florida.
And Chris, I want to
just
thank
one,
you.
Only where, one.
Where no, we go? Got oh. lots of beautiful ones, but it's one that's closest to my heart because it was 50 miles away from where I lived, and this is where we spent a lot of our time as kids. And I see it failing now.
I was going to thank you, Chris, for the
major
script.
He was going to thank you, but then he changed his mind.
No, we it's been a pleasure.
Play the song. Play the song.
Anyway, so what river are we singing about?
By the name of Newt Perry, he was a champion swimmer from Ocala, Florida. Served in the U.S. Navy during World War II as an underwater demolition expert. And after World War II, defeating the fascist Nazi Germans, he retired and came back to his home state of Florida, and he opened up a tourist attraction. It's beloved by so many people, and that the Seminole Indians called the Little Winding River Uiki Ki Wachichi River. It meanders west towards the Gulf of Mexico, past a little town called Bayport. Reborn in 1947, after her father helped win the Second World War, and he fell in love with a place near heaven where she rises from her mother's soul, and she's a marvelous attraction. You can see a curve from the main road. Yeah, she's a sideshow distraction by any means. You just watch her. She boils when she moves. And you can see her through the water, crystal clear, as she rises from her mother's stove under a blue sky. Morning sunrise, and in one quick glance, she will catch your eyes. And when she touches you, you never want to say goodbye. She's a fine catch, and she will capture your gaze.
Yeah, she's a real fine catch. But you better watch her when she plays. She's a fine catch. She's a real sight to behold. Just be careful with her heart. You know her blood runs cold. And if she takes you waltzing west of Bayport, you're gonna surely taste her lips at sunset down on the Gulf of Mexico. And on a full moon, how tight you get to see her bosom rise. The deep blue below, all the stars in the sky. She's a fine catch, and she will capture your gaze. Yeah, she's a real fine catch, but you better watch her when she plays. She's a fine catch, her angel hand in the waves. She's a real fine catch. Don't you dare let this one get away. She's a fine catch, and you will be amazed. If I catch, she's a wicky watchy mermaid. Ba-da-da-da. Ba-da-da-da-da-da. So we kiki watchy chi 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 mermaid.
All right. You're listening to the Florida Folk Show on Radio St. Pete, Sunshine 96.7 FM, WMTBLP, St. Petersburg, where local music lives. Thank you to everyone who came out today. Just want to remind everyone, we mentioned it last week, St. Pete Mountain Boys are tonight at Crooked Thumb up in Safety Harbor, and then tomorrow they're having a John Prine tribute to commemorate the passing of John Prine a number of years back. Gosh, what was that, like 3 or 4 years ago now? But yeah, and then after that, Have Gun Will Travel is going to be playing at Crooked Thumb tomorrow, I think from 4 to 7, so that would be fun. Do we have anything coming up? What's our next folk night on Wednesdays? Do we have one?
On the 17th of April with Sarasota Slim at the Study.
There you go.
You got something to play while we go off here?
All right, yeah, I'll
close. Thanks it again to the Florida Institute of Oceanography and the RV Western Flyer.
Yeah.
And University of South Florida and all the other great institutions that comprise this beautiful marine educational paradise we have here in St. Petersburg.